This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers, and of course we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295, but please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us this evening Dr. Boyd Haley. He is chairman of the Department of Chemistry at the University of Kentucky, and he's done a lot of very, very fundamental work on the relationship between mercury and Alzheimer's disease and other diseases as well. So without further ado, thank you very much for being with us this evening.
You're welcome.
Well, why don't you tell our listeners, and remember, this is a new audience. You haven't necessarily talked to them before. They don't know who you are. How was it you began to begin looking for the relationship between mercury and Alzheimer's disease? Certainly, this is not what most chemists would be doing.
No, although my degrees are in chemistry, my background and my research has mainly been in biochemistry. And I didn't go looking for mercury causing a disease. I was working in a, you know, had my laboratory, just had recently moved to the University of Kentucky, and one of my graduate students who got her PhD went to work in an Alzheimer's research center and came back and was discussing with me some of the problems they had. So we just decided to do a project in the lab on Alzheimer's disease, trying to find out what biochemistry would have gone wrong in the brain of an Alzheimer's patient versus a normal patient, because we had samples of normal brain and Alzheimer's brain. And what we found several biochemical aberrancies which have held up today. No one says I'm wrong about the aberrancies I described. Matter of fact, they were very excited about what we had found. Where my research ran into problems was when we started doing research to say what would cause these problems in a normal brain sample, you know, that would make it appear like an AD brain. And essentially, roughly about 1988, we started publishing research that showed that mercury, and only mercury, when added to normal brain, would cause the same biochemical aberrancies that we saw in AD brain. And since that time, this has been established by other research laboratories that you can make all of the diagnostic hallmarks, the pathological hallmarks of Alzheimer's disease by treating either rats by exposing them to mercury vapor or taking neurons in culture and treating with mercury. If this were any other element or any other material, I think people would say, well, these guys have found the cause of Alzheimer's disease.
But of course, the thing is that, we know that mercury is toxic to the brain. In fact, they're talking now about, telling people, eating in fish restaurants that, the fish may have a certain amount of mercury in them that can be harmful. We know that mercury is a terribly toxic substance and is toxic to the brain. So why is there all the objection to pointing out that mercury can be related to Alzheimer's disease?
Well, people are absolutely encouraged to say, the mercury in fish may be bad for you, or the mercury coming from a coal-fired power plant might be bad for you. And, I have no disagreement with that, but if you really look at the scientific studies where they have taken cadavers that have died, for example, in automobile wrecks or heart attacks, and they measure the mercury in their tissues, the main contributor to mercury in the body comes from your dental amalgams. But the American Dental Association fights this. They want to tell people this can't be, this is not what's happened, but in actuality, that's what has happened.
All right, well, hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with Dr. Boyd Haley, Chairman of the Department of Chemistry, the University of Kentucky, and try to get the message out, and some people don't want you to hear it. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest is Professor Boyd Haley of the University of Kentucky, and we're talking about the relationship between Alzheimer's disease and a dental amalgam. And I think most people actually somehow think these are silver fillings. They look silver, they're hard. What's the background of the dental amalgam, and why is it so dangerous?
Well, a dental amalgam is a mixture of 50% mercury, about 20% silver, and then different combinations of tin, zinc, and copper. And it does make into a hard filling that slowly emits mercury. And you can measure the mercury coming off of an amalgam. I have my freshman chemistry students do that in a class I teach called Mercury Science and Politics. We take amalgams that are made outside the mouth, or we take teeth that have been extracted that have amalgams, in the teeth. And I have the students measure that, and they even measure the mercury in each other's mouths. I mean, this is not rocket science. This is done with a very simple instrument that OSHA uses in our university to see if we have mercury in our classrooms. And there's no doubt about it. Amalgams constantly emit mercury. For example, a 1 gram filling, which would be maybe a 2 spill filling for those who know anything about dental, which is not an abnormally large filling, would have about 400 milligrams of mercury in them, or almost a half a gram of mercury, if you want to look at it that way. And it's in our mouth, and the vapors are constantly coming off 24 hours a day, and it comes off faster when we eat, and faster when we chew gum, and faster when we drink hot drinks. That's all established. There's not any... I mean, I would challenge the ADA or anybody else, if they want to see me demonstrate that, tell me when and where, and we'll go demonstrate it. And I want them to demonstrate an amalgam filling that doesn't release mercury, that can't be detected with a mercury vapor sniffer. I mean, it's just, there's no scientific controversy here. there's just a controversy, you know, about whether, like you might have if you could find probably 100 people who think the Earth is flat and would argue with you. So you have a controversy, but it doesn't mean that their argument holds any water. This is lopsided. I mean, the science is, you know, and the chemistry is so easy to do to show that amalgams release a lot of mercury vapor. And that's virgin mercury. That's mercury that has never reacted with anything. It penetrates the cell membranes, and once it gets inside the body, it gets oxidized to the most toxic form. In contrast, the mercury in fish has been in a living biological system for a long time, and much of that mercury is not toxic because it's tied up with selenium, which renders the mercury, you know, almost non-reactive.
But, of course, doesn't this then absorbed into your system and actually, you know, is absorbed directly into the system, and much of this can directly get into the brain? Before you answer that, just hold just one moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Boyd Haley, professor of chemistry at the University of Kentucky, chairman of the Department of Chemistry at the University of Kentucky, and trying to get the truth out about the danger of dental amalgam. Now, the American Dental Association, in my opinion, doesn't dare let this information get out. Why, if they did, think of the potential liability for every dentist in America who's put in dental fillings. And certainly, as far as I'm concerned, the dentists aren't at fault in this. In fact, my understanding is that 100 years or so ago, wasn't it almost considered malpractice to put in mercury fillings?
Yes. In the first American Dental Association, it's called the American College of Dental Surgeons, and if you were part of that organization, which was the main organization, you had to sign an oath that you would not place mercury in people's mouths, because even back then they knew that it was dangerous and it was toxic.
In fact, people who worked with mercury, they went mad. The expression, mad as a hatter. It was the toxic effect of mercury. They knew that. The dentists knew it 100 years ago. So how did they get so much smarter after that? Or how did they lose being so smart, I should say?
It's an amazing story that is just really hard for me to comprehend how it happened. I think that people really were so naive that when they mixed mercury with, you know, back in the 1830s, when we didn't have devices to measure mercury coming off, they made amalgam fillings, and they saw it was hard as a rock, and they thought, and it lasted years, and so they would think, well, there's no mercury coming off of this. But, you know, if you lost 5 micrograms a day from an amalgam filling, that would be a toxic amount. And if you understand that, say, a 1 gram filling would have about 500,000 micrograms, you've got 100,000 days, and that's a lot of times, a lot of years. I mean, it's over 100 years that amalgam could exist. So I just think they blatantly look at it and said, well, look, it looks hard, so therefore the amount of mercury is not coming out, and it would be safe. And to be honest with you, I know that the ADA has tested this. I know they know how much comes off. It's too simple. It's too easy to do. And, for the audience, if they think I'm just, crackers, you know, the easiest way to shut me up would be to encourage the Food and Drug Administration or some university to make amalgams outside the mouth and absolutely publish an article stating how much mercury comes off of a 1 gram filling, you know, made the size in the shape of an aspirin, so you know the surface area. They won't do that. They can't do that because I'm right, and they know they can't do it. And, you know, the bottom line and what really should discourage people and really get them angry and have them demand some action from our government is just like the FDA doesn't mandate any, you know, doesn't require any testing of Vioxx or any proof that it was safe. They have never, ever tested the mercury that comes off of a dental amalgam. The Food and Drug Administration approves it, gives it, makes it available to the dentist to use on the American public, and they have never, ever tested it. That's a testimony given before Dan Burton's congressional committee.
Well, now, is there any place up in the Internet where people could go and see the picture of the fumes coming off the tooth? We actually have a video, of course. We carry the uninformed consent video where you can actually see the fumes coming off there with this mercury filter that you have. But is there any place that people can go on the Internet to check this out?
Well, you know, the one site you mentioned, the uninformed consent, it's a very good one, but the IAOMT.org. It's IAOMT.org. You can go there and you can order the tape if you want it. You can get the CD sent to you. and you can view it. And it's, like I say, it's very sensible. It's very easy to do.
All right.
If anybody wanted to know, I may put it on my website, how to set it up so you can see it in your own chemistry classroom in a high school. It's not a hard thing to do.
Well, now, that is the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology.
That's
the
right.
International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, the RIAOMT. And that's an excellent website, incidentally, because it lists there the dentists who are trained to take the mercury out. You don't want to go down to your local dentist and say, hey, I want to get my mercury out of my fillings. What can happen? What problem can you get into, if you just go to your dentist and they start just taking the mercury out?
Well, you know what? What's been proven by some Swedish studies is that the mercury level, depending on how many amalgams you have taken out, but your mercury level in your blood can go up over tenfold by just having your amalgam fillings removed, because you swallow the chips, and the chips of the mercury amalgams, still leak mercury when they're in your intestines. And plus you breathe a lot of it while they're drilling it out in the classroom. I mean, we can show that, and I've done this several times on several news programs where I've shown that an amalgam in a tooth, if you brush it with a toothbrush, the vapors coming off increase dramatically. I mean, several fold. And the same thing happens when they put a real high-speed drill on it. I mean, maybe we should make a picture of that, of the drill, how much mercury comes off an amalgam filling when it's hit with a dentist drill. I mean, it would be tremendous. So these people, if you are a person susceptible to mercury, and if you're suffering from, some neurological deficit and chronic fatigue, etc., you certainly don't want to go get a bolus amount of mercury. So go to the IAOMT website and find yourself a well-trained dentist who has at least gone to the classes and has the intelligence and the honesty to say, hey, this stuff is dangerous.
Well, now, of course, some dentists, there are some states in the union where if a dentist talks about or mentions to a patient that they ought to get their mercury out of their mouth, they'll lose their license, won't they?
Yes, there's a gag order, supported by a lot of the American Dental Association founded state boards. And dentists that have said this they'll come in and try and take their license. That's happened several times. They're now getting more clever. They come in and try and get them for not keeping good records or something. But if a dentist is outspoken about removing mercury or dental amalgams, they're in most states, the state board will come after them.
Well, I think it's significant that in Sweden, my understanding is that they have done everything they could to discourage people from having the dental fillings, and they won't even pay for a mercury filling, will they?
No, they won't. And Sweden has the state government will pay for you to have your amalgams replaced with composite fillings, because they think that it'll cost them less money down the line by decreasing the amount of money they'll have to spend for these people getting ill or developing neural developmental problems.
And so they, in Sweden, they recognize what's going on. Either they're incredibly foolish or they're poisoning the American people with the dental fillings. Well, now, of course, the dental fillings, the effect of mercury is on the brain. Does it have other effects on the human body? In other words, what other things will mercury do? What other parts of our physiology are affected by the mercury poisoning?
Well, the one thing we know, first of all, that it's a major poison of the kidney. But the thing that really I think most people aren't aware of is that when you have idiopathic dilated cardiomyopathy, and that's where people just drop dead, especially at very young ages, or where they require heart transplant because they have a myopathy of the cardiovascular, of the heart. These people, in one report that came from Switzerland, these people had 22,000 times higher level of mercury in their heart tissue than they had in their muscle tissue, and 22,000 times higher than what was found in the average people who died of other forms of disease. So mercury, with certain individuals, appears to collect in their heart tissues at extremely high levels. And there's no way that much mercury could be good for your heart.
And, of course, one of the things that will do is interfere with reproduction and testosterone and the whole reproductive process. That can be affected by the mercury as well, can't it?
Yes, there have been several reports. There's no doubt that the hormones, the hormone receptors that are regulated by follicle stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, those receptors lose their ability to interact with the hormone. when they're exposed to mercury.
And, of course, here is a substance which is toxic to the brain. And, of course, there seems to be a very definite relationship to Alzheimer's disease, and yet nothing is being done to get this out of the teeth. In fact, anybody who suggests this is immediately attacked and vilified by the American Dental Association, and you have to ask yourself, why? Now, my understanding is actually that some innovative researchers have actually put dental fillings, mercury fillings, into sheep, you know, because they wanted to know what the effect was. Are you acquainted with those studies? And
yes, I've read those.
What did they show?
Well, what they did is in both sheep and monkey, they placed amalgam fillings, put the sheep asleep and the monkeys asleep, put in amalgam fillings as they would into a human, and only they were contained radioactive mercury, and they followed the radioactive mercury as it left the amalgam fillings and collected in the body tissues. And what they were showing is that, yes, that in a very short period of time, the mercury from your fillings ends up in your liver, your kidney, your brain, and it was amazing how much ended up in your jawbone. That was the highest level, and we have a lot of problems. And the one thing we know is that mercury is one of the major exacerbating factors, the mercury from dental amalgams, of periodontal disease. And periodontal disease has been, the severity of periodontal disease has been correlated and as a direct risk factor for a huge number of systemic illnesses, including low birth weight babies, late onset insulin-independent diabetes, cardiovascular disease, atherosclerosis. It goes on and on. And so what we're doing in our mouths by putting a toxic metal in there is making it even more susceptible to bacterial infection. So mercury is not good for any living system. I mean, it is toxic to every biochemical system in your body. It's just that some are more sensitive than others. And we need to get rid of mercury out of our mouths. I mean, it's one of the dumbest things that humans have ever done.
Well, when I first heard about this, I suppose the early 1980s when I was getting interested in doing acupuncture, and I was so skeptical about that, and I look back on those days and say, how could I have been so foolish not to have realized that there really was very valid points. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Boyd Haley. If you're out there in the listening audience, you have a question or comment, why, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And we'll look forward to talking to you right here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Boyd Haley. We're talking about the toxicity of dental fillings. We're really talking about the toxicity of mercury as a whole, because I'm sure that Dr. Haley, well, let's get Dr. Haley's feeling about, what about the thimerosal that's been in our vaccines that they were giving to our children when they were in the nursery? The first day of birth, they were giving the hepatitis B vaccine with mercury in it, with doses of thimerosal, which would be up to 87 times. There was a recent article, that Los Angeles Times had come up with, that found that Dr. Hillman, who had worked for Merck, had pointed out that they were using this and they were giving the children 87 times, I think it was, the level of mercury that was the maximum let out by the EPA for these newborn children.
Right. The amount of mercury, and this is something that anyone that's very good with math, if they have a pencil down, can write down these numbers. There's 12.5 micrograms of mercury in the vaccine given to these infants on the day they were born. The EPA says you have a tenth of a microgram per kilogram body weight that's safe. So if you divide a tenth of a microgram into 12.5 micrograms, you come up with 125 kilograms that a person would have to weigh for that vaccine to be safe according to EPA standards. And there's 2.2 pounds per kilogram, so the person would have to weigh 275 pounds for that vaccination to be safe on the, that they give to the babies on the day they're born. Now, these babies weigh anywhere from 4 to 8 pounds on the average, I would say somewhere in that range, so you can do the math yourself. And the interesting thing is, and what's so annoying, is that in 1977, in a hospital in Toronto, they went back and checked. They had treated 13 babies for infected umbilical cords. And part of the treatment was to through a topological application of a material called methylate. Methylate was red, and many of your older people, listeners, will know that's the stuff you used to paint on your body that was red. All of us have used that are having the age to us. But they put that on, and they killed 10 of the 13 babies. And after the 13th one died, they decided they better be looking and finding a reason, because this was unacceptable that these babies would die of this infection. And when they tested their tissues, they found out that they died of mercury toxicity. And so after 1977, that's when we took methylate and mercuricum off of the market. We took it out of the optical contact lens solution. And yet the Einsteins that run our vaccine program decided in 1985 that it would be okay to inject huge doses of this into babies on the day they're born. And I think that is what has given us, you know, the huge amount of neurodevelopmental problems we have in our children today, which according to the CDC, 1 out of 6 children in the United States has a neurodevelopmental disorder, and 1 out of 166, or 60 out of 10,000, have autism. And I think the real cause is autism is just a name. It's a description they gave to children who seem to be involved just with themselves. But really what we're looking at is just a huge amount of mercury toxicity and autism and attention deficit hyperactive disorder and Asperger's syndrome are just different responses of different human beings to mercury toxicity.
And I think that the interesting thing, one of the things I've learned from talking to you and reading your work, is the fact that we all react differently as far as our ability to handle mercury. Everybody is not the same. Some people can excrete it and get away with it. Others, of course, retain it. They can't excrete it. And, of course, they then become so susceptible. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Boyd Haley. We're talking about the problem referable to ingestion, not really the ingestion, more the injection of mercury into our children with our vaccinations, and then, of course, the amalgam in our mouth. Well, we've got Jeff calling from Providence, Rhode Island. Hi, Jeff. How are you doing?
How are you doing? Good evening.
Good evening. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I do. Dr. Haley?
Yes.
Yeah, hi. My mouth is literally full of amalgam fillings, and I'm wondering if there's a way, short of removing those fillings, of sealing them, possibly skimming the surface of the amalgams and sealing it with, like they do with children's teeth now, with a plastic or polymer coating, rather than going through the expense and trouble of removing the fillings.
I'm not a dentist.
Okay.
I would tell you I really doubt that there's anything you could put on surface. What would happen with all the mercury doesn't just leak out the top of the amalgam as vapor. It goes down into the tooth, into the jawbone. That's where the preponderance of it goes. And the margins, in other words, the distance between the amalgam and the tooth, that's under the tooth, that's not on the surface where you can see it. The mercury atom would go through that like a Volkswagen would go down a freeway. And if you look at the sheep studies where we talked about earlier with the radioactive studies on sheep and monkeys, the highest concentration of mercury, radioactive mercury in those monkeys was in the jawbone. And when it gets in the jawbone, it gets into your bloodstream and it just goes throughout your body. So I don't think you can seal it with anything.
I didn't realize that. That's a very good information. I know that as a chemist you might have looked into this. There's a metal called gallium, which is it's not a liquid metal like mercury, but it can be alloyed with tin.
Yes.
And silver. And I'm wondering if you have there's a new amalgam based on gallium metal. Any information about that?
Well, I have not done any individual research on gallium because it hasn't been used a lot, but it has its own toxicity profile, and it may be that it would be much safer than mercury. I mean, I really just don't know.
I'd suggest, Joe, Jeff, if you're going to do anything, go to the IAO. Let's see, IAOMT website, International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology. Go to their website. They've got a lot of information in there about getting the mercury fillings out.
I will. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
And by the way, my wife had 15 when I first saw my research results. And she had them removed, doing a quarter of the mouth at a time. And she survived it. She's scared to death of dentists, and I can tell you that her health, and she would say that her health dramatically improved on getting those 15 amalgams out.
Okay.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. And our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But I really believe that this is such an important subject. We keep coming back to it because we have, you know, several hundred million Americans who are just sitting on a time bomb with a mouth full of mercury fillings. And there is an organized effort to disparage anybody who talks against them, and yet I think increasingly the average individual realizes that there's a problem, and I know more and more dentists are really getting very skittish about this, and at least I think the honest ones are going to composite fillings without perhaps making a big fuss about this, because they certainly don't want to have the dental boards coming after their medical licenses. I think it takes a lot of courage as a dentist today to stand up against the power of the dental boards. But you got to do what's right. Now, our guest this evening is Dr. Boyd Haley. We're talking about the danger of mercury. Where should people go to get more information? Are there good websites up there besides that IAOMT?
Oh, yes. I mean, I think if you go to google.com and put in amalgam toxin, amalgams and safety, or amalgams and mercury, it will take you to such a large number of sites. There's one called Toxic Tooth. There's the Uninformed Consent site. There's the IAOMT site. I have a company. We don't do anything with mercury or amalgams, but I got so tired of, you know, lawyers and people, dentists, asking me for publications. So I put up my own site. So if you go to www.altcorp, that's altcorp.com, and go to dental information, there's just thousands of articles that I've read, you know, in fighting this thing, that's on there that you can click on and print, and you know, and it doesn't cost anything. We just do it as a service because I just got angry at what the dental associations were saying.
All right, and of course they have a vested interest in being you know, being not letting this information out, because you know, if they ever came out and said we've been telling you, the dentist, the wrong information and you're in real trouble, why, of course, they would lose a lot of their support. We'll be right back in just a moment here. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Dr. Boyd Haley. We're talking about the toxicity of mercury, and one of the things I was really so intrigued was some of these studies that have been done where they analyze hair. And of course, we ordinarily think, well, you know, if you find mercury in the hair, why, that means that that gives you some reflection of the idea of mercury in the body. But would you like to perhaps discuss those studies?
Sure. This is the study that, you know, I was involved in, that kind of showed that the autistic children, you know, were a subset of the population that do not effectively excrete mercury. And it's really a simple concept. If you are a person that when mercury enters your body, that it gets into your central nervous system or into your tissues, and it can't be excreted, and in other words, it doesn't come out, you will have very low levels of mercury in your hair even though you've been exposed. In contrast, the bulk of humans who can excrete mercury relatively effectively, if they're exposed to the same level of mercury, will be excreting it, kicking it out into their bloodstream, and it ends up, you know, high in the blood, high in the urine, and high in the hair. So what we find with autistic children, they have very low levels of mercury in their hair, but if you test their body tissues, like an extracted tooth, they will have a huge excess of mercury. And what I want to tell the, you know, I think it's really important that we get across to your listening audience is that there, you know, for what we call autism today, what is diagnosed by the most pediatricians as autism or attention deficit hyperactive disorder. If you go to the Defeat Autism Now Foundation website or to the Autism Research Institute website in California, you will see that there are protocols now called the DAN Protocol, Defeat Autism Now Protocol, where they are treating these children, you know, for mercury toxicity, and a huge number of these children are going out of the diagnostic spectrum as being autistic. In other words, they're able to go back to school, they start talking, they make eye contact, and so you can treat these children. And, you know, according to medicine, autism is a non-treatable disease. And if you treat them with chelation therapy and, you know, give them the supplements that are needed to replace the damage done by mercury, some of these children can make a marked improvement.
And I really think this is one of the most interesting things. There's almost an effort now to keep from treating these. There's articles in the New York Times saying, well, I'm autistic. Why do you want to change me? I'm happy the way I am. And you know, you're wondering what this is all about, almost as if there's an organized effort to prevent many of these children from getting the benefits of this large studies that have been done that show if you get the mercury out of the body has an amazing capacity to recover. We'll be back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course we were just talking about the fact that there are treatments for children with autism, and they involve, of course, getting the mercury out of their body, supplements to replace certain problems that they do have, and of course the websites that are suggested was the Autism Research Institute, is that correct?
Yes.
And then, of course, To Feed Autism Now. So these are two excellent websites. There's information there that have been gathered not by the government at all and not by the CDC, but I know we've talked to Dr. Remland of the Autism Research Institute.
Yes.
And, you know, they have records on some 24,000 autistic children where the parents have written in and said what helped them. And then compiling all of that information, putting it into some sort of a logical pattern, they've been able to come up with suggested treatments that parents can use that are not going to be widely talked about. Most doctors don't know about this because they read their journals that tell them there's absolutely nothing that can be done. But we're dealing with a frightening spectrum of disease, from autism to attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, to attention deficit disorder, to mental problems, the difficulty learning, to the point where the CDC says that one child in six in America has a neurodevelopmental abnormality. One child in six in America has a new neurodevelopmental abnormality. And, of course, how many of them are related to the thimerosal that they got from the vaccines that the government insisted that they take? Well, let's go to Roger calling from Allentown, Pennsylvania. Hi, Roger. You have a question for our guest.
Yes, thanks. My first of two questions kind of is off the previous caller, and that is I'm guessing neither of you are aware of any particular downside to either the porcelain or acrylic fillings, such that one should hesitate, right?
Well, Dr. Haley, do you want to comment on that?
Sure. I mean, you know, as far as the downside, I mean, I know that, you know, every type of filling has its own set of problems, but I think the problems from those two, as far as looking at it from a toxicity viewpoint, pale to insignificance compared to what you have with amalgam fillings.
I think that should be a pretty good response. Roger, do you have another question?
Yeah, lastly, and you may want to save this till later, but a long while back, you had with a dentist guest, I believe, and root canals, I take it universally, is that correct?
And, well, that of course is Dr. Kennedy, and that's a little off the subject here. I'm not an expert on it, and I don't think Dr. Haley would. Do you have any comment on the root canal, Bet?
Well, you know, I mean, it's, you know, one thing that we have worked on, and that's, you know, some root canals, and it's not my research. I mean, again, you go to the website, the AltCorp website, and go on dental information, you can look at the published research that, you know, many people have shown that certain, you know, a certain percentage of root canal teeth, they're dead avital teeth, and they can exclude bacteria from infecting or growing in the dentin tubules. And they can show that with electron microscopes and by testing and show that, you know, root canals can be a focal point of an anaerobic infection.
And I think that they're not good to have, and you certainly want another alternative. Okay, well, look, anything else, Roger?
Lastly, I heard somebody suggest that when you chelate for mercury, that you should perhaps go for other items first because somehow the other chelating agents would tend to bind the mercury or something more tightly.
Don't know anything about that. Can you comment on that at all, Dr. Hadley?
Well, I could give a two-hour lecture on chelation of heavy metals. That's chemistry, and I do know quite a bit about it. And you know, the thing is, it's just too complex to give a real short answer to in any short period of time. However, I would say this: the Institute of Medicine, when it did its review, and I think people have to understand that, you know, the information we've got, lawyers have obtained by subpoena, and that the Safe Minds Group, Safe Minds Organization, has got through Freedom of Information Act, you know, strongly indicate that the IOMT committee was a setup. They had a preconceived idea of what they were going to give before they even started. But they recommended that children not be chelated and that no more research be done on the concept that thimerosal might be causal for autism. And right now, you know, like I say, we're taking a lot of these autistic children diagnosed as such, and by treatment with chelation or treatment as if they're mercury toxic, we're getting them out of the autism diagnosis. Pardon me.
Right. Okay, thanks so much, Roger.
God bless.
Bye-bye. No, are they using that? Was it EDTA for chelation, or what are they using for chelation?
Well, there are several things, and I would point out that we don't have any modern chelators. I mean, it's never been very popular with modern medicine. EDTA is the chelator of choice for lead toxicity. But EDTA will not bind and remove mercury from the human body. I mean, the mercury has such high affinity for the sulfurs on proteins that EDTA will not pull it out. What EDTA does do that is good is that when you're mercury toxic, you retain lead, cadmium, copper, and other toxic metals to a higher level than you should, and the EDTA will remove those. But to get the mercury out, you have to use a chelator that has a sulfur group on it, such as DMPS or DMSA. And I don't even think that those chelators are that effective. They do work, and they do improve people. But what we really need is to develop, better chelators, those that will cross the blood-brain barrier, chelators that will get inside of cells and remove mercury from the sites where the mercury is doing damage.
All right,
we're archaic with the way we treat mercury toxicity.
Is there any research being done on that, to your knowledge?
Well, I know I'm working on it.
Okay, you're working on it. Okay. Well, that was really what I was asking.
Right.
Anyway, you are working on trying to come up with some sort of a mechanism for chelating more effectively. Now, what about Alzheimer's disease? You know, one of my good friends' wife is a victim of this, and just slowly losing more and more contact with the world. Is there any hope for people with Alzheimer's disease with chelation or with some of these other supplemental treatments?
Well, you know, I always think that, I think we have to work from a level of hope. And I know of people, and one of them just recently, a 48-year-old lady that was diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease. She had been a business executive. She lost her job, and her husband called me after he took her in, and she was diagnosed with early-onset Alzheimer's disease. She had scored 23 on the mini mental status test. She had an MRI done on her brain, and this fellow had, immediately got on the Internet and started looking around what causes it. He read some of my information and information of others. And he called me, and he asked, what should he do? And I told him I don't give medical advice, and I don't. I try not to play I do not play doctor, because a lot of people would like to catch me doing that, and I just don't do it. But anyway, he asked me, what would I do if she were my wife? And so I said, well, here's what I did with my wife. And, a lot of one, get her dental amalgams out. Put her immediately on selenium to keep from doing any, the mercury in her body from doing any further damage. Try to stop it. Put her on reducing vitamins. Eliminate any exposure to any form of mercury. Get her blood test to see what her ApoE type is.
What is that now?
The ApoE, apolipoprotein E. You can inherit two copies, one from your mom and one from your dad, and there are only three types, 2, 3, and 4. And people who have ApoE2 will never get Alzheimer's disease. I mean, they'll live to be 90 and never, or 95 and never get it. But people who have ApoE4, especially if they're what we call homozygote, in other words, if they're a 4-4, you can be 2-2, 2-3, 2-4.
Right, right.
And if you're 4-4, you're really susceptible. This particular lady that I'm talking about was a 4-4. And so that told me that she probably, and what it is 4 is 4 gives you, you know, this protein is second highest level in your body's in the cerebral spinal fluid. And if you have the ApoE2, you have increased buffering power against mercury coming in from your dental amalgams. If you're 4-4, you've lost that buffering power. You just don't have it. And so the mercury can get a straight shot into your brain right through your cerebral spinal fluid, or at least it's much easier. And that's my explanation of why the 4-4 is a major risk factor for early onset Alzheimer's. But anyway, this lady, this fellow, really loved his wife, and he did a marvelous job. And he also put her on infrared sauna, and I think he tried everything he could possibly do, you know, vitamin C, you know, supplementation as well as the selenium, etc. And his neurologist was very angry at him for doing this. He wanted to put her on Aricept, and he said no, he was going to treat her for mercury toxicity. And this was last July when I first heard from him. And this last week, he emailed me saying that he had gone back. His wife scored 28 on the mini mental status test. Her score had gone up. And that when they did the MRI of her brain, that what the physician said, you know, for certain it didn't get any worse. And so they think that they've stopped it in its tracks, and they're hoping that they can keep it under abeyance. And this is just, you know, again, treating the lady with the concept that she's been exposed to too much heavy metals, and they're doing chelation to try and get it out. Well, and I don't know if it'll reverse it, but it appears to have stopped it or slowed it down.
What is this test where she went from 23 to 28? I'm not really acquainted. Was that sort of an IQ or a perception test?
It's a perception. It's a mini mental status test, and it's a very simple test. Like, you know, I think they ask you your mother's name, the day of the week. It's something that, you know, a normal person would get 30 out of 30. 30 is the maximum you can get. But if you're demented or if you're losing your mind, it doesn't make any difference. I mean, something you would have easily known when you were okay, when you get in the early stages of Alzheimer's disease. So part of the diagnosis is that your mini mental status test score will continue to drop. I mean, you'll go, you know, to 25, to 20, to 15, on down like that. And so this lady was supposed to have done a lot worse, and she did better. And this guy, the neurologist, said this was only the second time, according to this lady's husband, this was only the second time in the history of that clinic that they had seen somebody do better on the mini mental status test after being diagnosed as Alzheimer's disease.
Well, now, you mentioned the infrared sauna, and I've heard a little bit about that, but could you describe that to our listeners and why that would be so important?
Well, you know, if you go back to any of these studies where they've looked at, you know, they inject the Marisol into an infant, and they say, well, the blood level is this level, and it dropped this in 5 days, where to go? Well, if you do a calculation on that and also look at how much mercury would come out in the feces of these children, because you know how much they, you know, how many grams of feces they produce per kilogram body weight, you can get an estimate. What you find out is that there's about 80 to 90% of the mercury not accounted for. I mean, it's not in your blood, and it's not in your feces, it's somewhere else in your body. And if you look at the tissues, when you look at other studies where they go around and look at tissues, they account for a very low percent. So there's, it appears as if there's a considerable amount, you know, in the dispersed throughout the muscle and the skin tissue. And people have claimed, and I don't know, I mean, I haven't measured this, but I know people have claimed that when you do infrared saunas, a lot of the mercury will come out in the sweat. And that's something supposedly used by the mercury miners to keep them from getting too toxic from the mercury that from the ore they're extracting. You know, again, I would tell everyone, this is just a good suggestion. I don't think the science on this has really been done very well, but this is something that this lady did use.
All right, fine. Well, I'd just like to cover one other thing, and that is, of course, some of these conferences, government conferences, that have been held to determine whether or not the thimerosal that was in the vaccines given to our children was producing mercury toxicity and responsible for the neurodevelopmental abnormalities. My understanding is that at some of these conferences, they've actually had material presented that there was no question at all that the children were getting toxic doses of mercury, and that this was not brought forward honestly by the people in these government-sponsored committees. Have you looked into that at all?
Well, I participated. I was there and testified in front of the Institute of Medicine along with about six or seven other scientists. Every presentation showed the toxicity of thimerosal. And some of them correlated extremely well with, you know, what's observed in autistic children. For example, we showed that the autistic children didn't excrete mercury very well. Dr. Jill James showed that these autistic children had very low levels of glutathione in their red cells, and that's the molecule that binds mercury and takes it out of your body. Dr. Richard Deeth testified that these children should probably not be able to make methyl B12 and therefore couldn't, you know, modify their DNA and RNA in the normal process, and that also is observed in these autistic children. And I could go on. Dr. Maddie Horning showed that if you gave thimerosal at the same amount per kilogram body weight to mice that are susceptible to autoimmune disease, you develop a mice that has both the biochemical and the clinical characteristics of an autistic mouse, if you could understand a mouse being autistic. And the thing is, everything there said, hey, this is really very likely, biologically, it all fit like a glove. And the IOM absolutely ignored that. And what they took to make their decision were the epidemiological studies primarily from the country of Denmark, done by people who work for the Stanton Serum Institute, which is a vaccine manufacturer in Denmark that makes and sells to the rest of the world thimerosal-containing vaccines, and vaccines that they are not allowed to use in the country of Denmark, because the Danish government has said thimerosal is too dangerous, we're taking it out, we're not going to inject this into our children, and yet they have an institute there that makes the vaccines with thimerosal and sells them to the United States. You know, our people have to understand, most of the vaccines that we take in the United States are not made in the United States. They're made in foreign countries. And if somebody says, is there a way that the terrorists could get at us? Well, you know, I think, you know, through the flu vaccine, if somebody wanted to really get to the United States, you know, go take over some of the, like they did in England, you know, make a vaccine, an influenza vaccine with a bacteria in it. And if the English hadn't reported it to our FDA, that's what people would have been taking this last year, you know, a bacteria-contaminated influenza shot. So I am not at all confident that our current FDA is doing a very good job for us.
Well, I'm not confident, I'm sure they're not. But right now, let's go to Bob, calling from Albany, New York. Bob, did you have a question for our guest?
Yes, I did. Excuse me a second here. Oh, yes. I've been going through some dental problems for, you know, a few years here. I mean, I wore braces when I was young.
Right, go ahead.
I started out with gum line fillings, all of a sudden in my mid-20s, and now I have a tremendous amount of amalgam in my mouth. I listened, you had somebody else before on the air.
Probably Dr. Kennedy we've had in talking about this, or Dr. Blaylock. Go ahead.
Yes, and I'm just wondering, you know, what is the remedy? I mean, do I have to have this all ripped out of my mouth to...
Now, that's a decision you're going to have to make, I think, on your own. We can't tell you what to do. We can only tell you that the scientific studies show that they're getting a constant plumes of mercury into your system if you have a mouthful of mercury filling. So if I could suggest you go to some of the websites we talk about, I will tell you that my wife recently had all of her mercury fillings out, and I certainly would not want to have a mouthful of mercury fillings.
Alrighty,
right now, hang on just a moment. Okay, was there anything else you wanted to ask, Bob?
Yes, sir. Do you have any type of, what are the websites that I could visit concerning this?
The one you would want to go to think about getting out your fillings out would be, of course, the International Academy of Oral Medicine and Toxicology, or IAOMT. IAOMT. Go to their website. They've got a lot of information there on that subject. Any other websites you think you ought to go to, Dr. Haley?
You know, that would be the best one because they have hyperlinks to everything else.
All right. Go there and you're on your own, okay? Let us know what you decide.
Ready, sir. Bye-bye. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Bye-bye. Let's go to Ari calling from Redwood City. Hi, Ari. How are you doing?
Hi. Good evening. What's the difference between ethyl and methyl mercury?
All right, that's a very legitimate question. What's the difference between ethyl and methyl mercury? We know that the thimerosal is ethyl mercury. What's the difference between them?
Well, you know, it's actually one carbon atom and two hydrogens. It's a very small difference. In the parlance of the 60s, the difference is oink and oink oink.
Okay.
I mean, they're both. They are both extremely neurotoxic compounds. And, you know, and I know that the people who want to say thimerosal is fine says ethyl mercury is not nearly as toxic as methyl mercury. And I say, so what? It's extremely toxic on its own right. And that's like saying, wine is totally safe to drink and you won't get drunk on it because whiskey has more alcohol content. There is a difference. And, and chemically and physiologically, there is a difference. So I don't argue that. But the bottom line is, ethyl mercury from the vaccines crosses the blood-brain barrier, gets into the brain, breaks down and releases mercury quicker than methyl mercury, leads to a higher concentration of mercury in the brain. And we're not talking about killing these kids. We're not talking about lethality. We're talking about interrupting a developmental nervous system in an infant. And ethyl mercury definitely has the capacity and the ability to do that.
Anything else, Gary?
Well, which kind is in the amalgam fillings?
Neither one.
It's neither.
What comes off?
That's just metallic mercury?
Yeah, just metallic.
Elemental mercury?
It's worse than that. It's what comes off the amalgam is mercury vapor. Mercury vapor is not reactive, but it goes right through the membranes of the nasal mucosa and get anywhere in your body. But once it gets inside your body, there's a specific enzyme called catalase. It takes the mercury vapor, which is not reactive, converts it to the mercury 2+ cation, and that's the toxic form.
Hey, we're going to have to let you go, Ari. We're out of time.
Thank you. Bye.
God bless. Bye-bye. Dr. Hitty, thank you so very much.
You're welcome.
Good night.
Good night. Bye.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and I'm afraid we're not going to get to Jack because this is the time of our program when I have to remind you that Radio Liberty is listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you out there listening to across America will decide that you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family of supporters and help us as we reach out across America. And with the information you're not going to get from Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity or Bill O'Reilly or Dan Rather or any of the other establishment communicators, but of course we're dealing with something that's poisoning the American people. And of course we have an excellent 4-tape set on mercury and toxic mercury. We have a great video on mercury. It's called Without Informed Consent. That's Without Informed Consent. And you may want to very well get our 4-tape sets on fluoride. We have our traditional 4-tape set. We have a fluoride update, fluoride 4-tape set update. We have an excellent video on the subject of fluoride. We have the book, The Fluoride Deception, fascinating book. And then, of course, we'll be having a sort of review of that this coming hour with my interviews with Dr. Folks. Then we will also have the book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life, by Dr. Russell Blaylock. Has an excellent section on fluoride, on mercury, on aspartame, which is NutraSweet, which is a poison made up of three poisons, not just one poison, but, of course, aspartic acid. It has phenylalanine, and it has methanol. That's what you drink, and you go blind. And we've mixed them all together because they taste sweet, and we're poisoning our children. So they know exactly what they're doing. They don't want you to know. If you'd like to get any of the items I've called, our telephone number is, again, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. And then I want to mention again that we are going to be reprinting my book, The Brotherhood of Darkness. And if we print enough of them, we can get the price down tremendously. So if you're interested in buying a case or getting a full case of The Brotherhood of Darkness, why, give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. There's 62 books in a case, and I think you'll be rather surprised. Give them a call at 1-800-544-8927. I think we have 40 cases we're going to have put up, and I think we're up to about 16 that are gone now. And when they're gone, Well, we'll just have to see what happens. But right now, we're hoping to move 40 of them, and then we'll have some for ourselves. But the important thing is that people all across America are going to be handing out Brotherhood of Darkness, because it goes into the spiritual aspect of the struggle in which we're involved. And until you understand that there are spiritual forces that are energizing the people in key positions in our society, whether they would be in the music industry, whether they would be in the corporations, whether they would be the people who wrote the Earth Charter, whether it would be working at the highest levels of our government in the White House, like, do you remember, of course, when Hillary Clinton brought Jean Houston into the White House to conjure up the spirits of Eleanor Roosevelt and Mohandas Gandhi? Or then, of course, Nancy Reagan going to the astrologer or getting the messages from the other world so she could advise Ronald. So really it's sort of bipartisanism, occultism. Well, you have to understand that Brotherhood of Darkness will take you in a true understanding of the other world that is out there. Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. If you'd like to get any of the information on any of the items we mentioned or on the cases of Brotherhood of Darkness, and what a wonderful opportunity to have something to give to people that can change their life. And then, of course, if you'd like to go to our website at radioliberty.com, you can hear our programs, as you know, 5 hours a day on radio, 5 hours a day on the Internet, 5 hours a day on the satellite, and 4 hours a day on shortwave. Please tell other people about our program. Encourage them to listen, to become informed, to understand what's going on. Pray for America. Pray for revival. And then please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And so, until Monday, when we'll be with you again, Dr. Stan, good night, and may the Lord be with you. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And of course, we welcome your calls from out across America at 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being. We have with us on the line right now Dr. Richard Folks, and he is the assistant editor of the Journal of Fluoride, which it's the magazine that tells about fluoride research. And, of course, his website is fluoride-journal.com. That's fluoride-journal.com. Dr. Folks, thank you so very much for being with us tonight.
Good evening.
Well, now, of course, you work with this journal, and it's a fascinating journal. It's up on the net. I had a hard time tracking it down, but I eventually did find it. And there's all sorts of research that's been gone on into the harmful effects of fluoride and even of water fluoridation. But why is it that the average physician, the average scientist, has never heard of the fluoride journal or the work that's been done along this line?
Well, this journal, of course, has been published now for about 37 years. And it was originally started by Dr. George Waldbott, because this is a man who migrated to the United States from Germany, had a lot of papers published in Europe, and found it was very difficult to get papers on fluoride published in the United States. And so he had to start his own journal after having a meeting and forming the International Society for Fluoride Research. The journal has never been indexed by Index Medicus, which, as you know, is run by the U.S. Public Health Service. And many articles, even though they may have been peer-reviewed, just don't see the light of day in the conventional medical journals and the dental journals.
Well, but why? You know, you would think that something as important as fluoride, certainly the fluoride activity, because so much of what we eat today has fluoride in it. Our toothpaste has fluoride in it, the insecticides and pesticides, even our water has fluoride in it. And this is certainly a very active, reactive metal, isn't it? It's an element, really, not a metal. It's a gas, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, fluorine, of course, is the 13th... most abundant element on Earth. It is so volatile that it isn't found by itself. It is combined with other elements such as calcium, phosphorus, and magnesium, and so forth. I think the reason, of course, for the low index of suspicion, and you find it repeated even in medical textbooks, that fluoride prevents dental cavities and is safe. But, of course, this is not the case. Certainly, if one looks at the industrial exposure, and exposure in other countries such as India and China, where it's a major public health problem.
So it's a major public health problem, and they want to get it out of their drinking water. Here in the United States, we want to put it into our drinking water for some incredible
well,
reason.
You know, well, of course, in China, they have a peculiar situation there. And, of course, the population is so large that you number sick people in the millions. Their major problem is that not only do they have fluoride in some of their well water, but they are great burners of coal, and the coal produces fluorine or fluoride, and this contaminates the food,
well,
the air,
and so forth.
We'll
be right back here in just a moment. Well, I guess this evening is Dr. Richard Foulkes, and of course he is the assistant editor of the Fluoride Journal, and talking about the problems that they have in China, where they burn coal, and then of course they get the fluoride in the food, and it gets into all sorts of things. Really, it's a terrible problem in China, isn't it?
Oh, yes. Well, it's surprising. I've visited China and had the privilege of seeing patients with skeletal fluorosis, which, as you know, is the extreme form of fluorosis, and you know, seeing the living conditions and so forth. And it's hard to believe, but they will burn coal inside houses without a chimney. And of course, the Chinese government is carrying out a great deal of research and carrying out a lot of effort to get the fluoride reduced in the wells, and also to provide proper stoves with ventilation in the houses. This is a major problem. I think the answer to your first question, although why, I think part of the answer is in a book recently published, written by Chris Bryson, The Fluoride Deception. And I would urge all of your readers to obtain this book and read it, and it tells a very intriguing story of deception, some of the political reasons why fluoride is really known as a protected pollutant.
And in fact, you've written a book review of the fluoride deception, Chris Bryson's book, haven't you?
Yes, I did for the Fluoride Journal. Incidentally, I'm an associate editor.
You're an associate editor. I'm sorry. What's the difference between an associate and assistant? Or is it?
Yeah, I'm darned if I know. So that's what it says on the masthead.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, of course, our guest this evening is Dr. Richard Foulkes, and he is the associate editor. Is that the associate or one of the associate editors?
One.
One of the associate editors, yeah. Is a Fluoride Journal, and you can actually find it's a little hard to find, but if you're persistent, well, you'll find it up on the internet and there's a Google. And then, of course, you can go back, and they have articles going back there for many years on all sorts of subjects related to the fluoride, its impact, the various studies that have been done. The studies that have been done in China that show definitely lowers the IQ and in the areas, of course, where they have excessive fluoride in the water, about 3 parts per million, you lose about 10 points in the IQ. And so what are we doing here in the United States? Why, we're putting it in 1 part per million, but then we get so much fluoride from other subjects. I mean, it's in our cereals, it's in so much of what we eat, while we're getting the same doses as well.
Yeah. The other thing that seems to protect us, of course, is that by and large we are better nourished than a lot of other countries.
We'll be back. Our guest this evening, Dr. Richard Foulkes, and we're just talking about what's happening in China to the people over there, that they're exposed to large doses of fluoride in the drinking water, their IQ goes down. And were you saying that you thought perhaps we were somewhat more protected here because of a better nutritional status?
Well, I think probably, and also, of course, there's the low index of suspicion. I think a recent paper that came out, and it was released to the press, where doctors found that a lady's symptoms were due to skeletal fluorosis and was contributed to by her drinking 1 to 2 gallons of tea a day. And tea, of course, is very high in fluoride.
In fact, I think the thing that was so intriguing is that most plants are too smart to pick up fluoride. I mean, they just won't, they just know that they shouldn't pick it up because it's a toxic substance. But for some reason or other, the tea plant does. And so you get very high levels of fluoride in tea. And of course, one glass of tea is probably not going to create a problem. But when you're drinking several gallons a day, you can get in real problems, can't you?
Sounds like an awful lot of tea, doesn't it?
It sure does. Well, let's talk a little bit about Chris Bryson's book, The Fluoride Deception, because I think this is really so important. I think he's got a lot of great information in there. Would you like to sort of give an overview of what Mr. Bryson found after he researched the background of why there's been such a cover-up of the toxicity of fluoride and why they're so intent upon putting it in our drinking water and why they're spending countless millions of dollars to get the various political bodies, the very state legislatures, to go along with their agenda of putting fluoride in their drinking water?
Yeah, well, first of all, one thing I would encourage people to read this book is it's very readable. Chris Bryson is a prize-winning investigative reporter. He's produced some television documentaries for the BBC, and he really did his homework on this book. Although he had published a previous article with Joel Griffiths for the Earth Island Journal called Cavity's Teeth and the Fluoride Teeth and the Atomic Bomb, I think it was the title.
Fluoride Teeth and the Atomic Bomb. And people would probably say, what does fluoride and teeth have to do with the atomic bomb? But it has a great deal to do with the atomic bomb.
Well, sure it does. And this is what Chris points out, of course, that it was a cover-up for the secret work done to produce the atomic bomb during the war, where to create the proper type of uranium, one has to use uranium hexafluoride. And in the process of producing the atomic bomb, tons of fluoride pollution spew out through the stacks of the factories. And, of course, the first sign was that orchards and agricultural lands are being damaged by the fluoride, because plants are extremely sensitive to fluoride as well. And also there were suspicions that a number of illnesses of people living near the plants and also the workers was being compromised. So that the original work, as he points out, was to try to make fluoride, a benign substance, say, well, it's good for the teeth.
Well, of course, the big thing was that they did not want to have any medical liability for the fact that they were poisoning the agriculture and they were poisoning the people close to the plants. Would that be
fair? Well, they were being sued, so there was, you know, legal reasons for doing this. And, of course, they were cooperated by some very powerful people. And this is all shown in Bryson's book.
Which we do carry hither at Radio Liberty if you're interested in knowing more about it. That's called The Fluoride Deception by Chris Bryson. But please pick up the story. Go right ahead. So you're saying that they started out, they were going to try to do something to actually create the impression that fluoride was really not harmful at all.
Yeah, well, that was a thing. And, of course, there had been some studies earlier on in the 30s that indicated that small amounts of fluoride might prevent dental cavities. This has been disproved now, of course, although there is an argument for the topical application of fluoride. You certainly don't have to drink it in order to protect the teeth.
In fact, both the CDC and the American Dental Association have come out with articles saying fluoride does not act by ingestion. It acts locally, and its only effect really is local by actually cutting down on the incidence of bacteria, and it's the bacteria that produce the caries. The bacteria then attack the tooth and through an enzymatic process dissolve the enamel and get down to the tooth. So it acts topically. But so if it acts topically, why are we ingesting it? Why are they pushing that? It really doesn't make sense. And both the CDC and the American Dental Association have come out with that. What's so interesting is I wrote to the American Dental Association, or at least the Journal of the American Dental Association, asked for permission to actually include the front page of their article out of the Journal of the American Dental Association saying that that ingestion really didn't do any good. It all acted topically. And can you imagine they refused to give me permission, and they were nice enough to send me back a fax saying, we, of course, we will not allow you to do that. We're terribly sorry. So I'm just going to put that in my syllabus that I'm putting together. For some reason or other, the Journal of the American Dental Association doesn't want that one page circulated that says that it doesn't do any good to ingest fluoride.
No, well, they've got a lot invested in pushing fluoridation. Now, of course, one thing of great concern, too, is what is used in the water supply, and it's usually fluorosilicic acid or sodium fluoride silicate, which is a waste product of the phosphate fertilizer industry, primarily from Florida. And this in itself is a toxic waste product of the industry and contains all sorts of goodies like arsenic, cadmium, and even radioactive material.
And don't forget the lead.
And the lead.
Right.
And this, of course, provides a very good way of getting rid of a toxic waste product without having to go through all the hoops of holding ponds and treatment and so forth.
And so what they're doing is these people are putting up fabulous amounts of money to influence the legislatures and certainly buying the support of the Dental Association to encourage this being put in our drinking water. In the name of it, it's helping the children.
Yeah. And actually, when you take a look at how much water is consumed by children, it's less than 1% of the total water that's fluoridated. So most of the fluoride goes through the sewer system into the rivers and is, again, another pollutant to be concerned about.
Well, of course, my concern is the physiological impact on the bodies of not only the children, but the adults who actually ingest this fluoridated water, because they're getting not only the fluoride out of their water, they're getting the fluoride that's on the vegetables that have been sprayed with fluoride, because we can't use DDT. Well, that would be terrible, so we're going to spray the vegetables, and then we get it in our cereals, and certainly in many of the drinks we drink, and the grape juice we drink, and if you look at some of the material that will be in our syllabus, why fluoride is in almost everything, And by the time you add it all up, we're really getting toxic doses of fluoride every day, aren't we?
Yeah, it's even in the wine, because fluoride compounds are used as antifungicides in the wine industry on the grapes. That's why the grape juice has fluoride in it as well. And, of course, if you have anything made up from concentrate in a fluoridated area, then that's another dose of fluoride. But I think the one thing we have to be really concerned about is when one studies industrial workers, particularly in aluminum factories, and when one studies people in China, and both of these groups have skeletal fluorosis from long-term exposure to fluoride, you come to the conclusion that before the X-ray findings that the diagnosis is based on are produced, the patient has a lot of other symptoms that are pretty common, and one wonders just how many people in Canada and the United States living in fluoridated areas are taking Tums for stomach problems when the stomach problems are probably the early signs of fluoride intoxication. And also, before the X-ray findings, there's stiffness, there's calcification of tendons and other orthopedic symptoms and signs. And also in India, they've shown where fluoride is a major problem from the drinking water supplies, that it shows all the signs of hypothyroidism.
And so the fluoride attacks the thyroid, or it actually competes for the iodine, and of course it's toxic to the thyroid. It cuts down on thyroxine production.
Well, at one time it was used as a treatment for hyperthyroidism, because as you say, it does attack the thyroid gland specifically, and it is not just a process of competing with the iodine, although I'm sure that that does occur. But so these subtle symptoms are the kind that we sort of deal with every day, and one wonders just how many people in the United States and Canada are really suffering from fluorosis rather than arthritis of unknown cause and this type of thing.
And of course, the thing is, of course, if you're so many people today are hypothyroid, and the question is, how much of that that's hypothyroid disease is directly related to the fact that the tremendous consumption of fluoride that we're getting from all sorts of sources, and especially aggravated by water fluoridation, because we know that, of course, the fluoride attacks the thyroid, suppresses the thyroid, and the doctors aren't looking at that, because after all, we're told that fluoride is healthy. Well, we have to have fluoride, and it's so good for children's teeth. We'll be back here in just a moment with our special guest, Dr. Richard Foltz, and of course we'll welcome your calls at 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening, Dr. Richard Foltz, who is the associate editor, or one of the associate editors of Fluoride, the Fluoride Journal, and of course, trying to get the information out on fluoride. And as I've read your article, you have professors and researchers from all over the world writing in this journal, don't you?
Oh, yes. The International Society of Fluoride Research is made up of all kinds of different professions, physicians, orthopedic surgeons, physiologists, toxicologists, plant physiologists, veterinarians, you name it. And if they have anything to do with fluoride, they're members of the society and contributors to the journal.
Well, now, what effect does the fluoride have specifically on the reproductive mechanism, the reproductive organs of the of animals and humans? Do we know?
Now, there have been, there's a group in India that have done a lot of studies on the effect of fluoride on fertility. And the lady's, the doctor's name is Chinoy, C-H-I-N-O-Y, I believe. And they've certainly indicated that fluoride has an adverse effect. Now, there are reports from India, epidemiological reports, that's reports of studies of populations that there is a decrease in fertility in these fluoride, high fluoride areas.
No,
and also there has been a study in the United States that suggested people living in, males living in fluoridated areas or high fluoride water supplies do suffer a reduction in fertility.
And so is that both sperm motility, and my understanding is some of these people have been shown to have a significant decrease in testosterone level as well.
Yeah, I've read that. I don't know of any specific study on that, but it sounds logical. Because fluoride, of course, is an enzyme inhibitor, so it can act on any organ in the body. And, for example, there's studies showing abnormal electrocardiograms, effects on the kidneys, and of course you've already mentioned the effect on the brains producing low IQ, as well as the thyroid gland.
Well, this really is what's so frightening, because of course, if you affect the IQ, you lower the IQ, what does that do to our children? And the interesting thing is that apparently in the fluoridated areas in China, and there are two studies that are both published in the Fluoride Journal, that point out that it knocks off up to, what, about 10 points of the IQ?
Oh, yeah. Well, of course, there's some of those organophosphines that are in the environment have also produced it. It was a book published a few years ago, Our Stolen Future, that pointed that out.
Now,
of course, it's not just the individual that suffers, it's the society.
Now, I'm sorry, was this book, Our Stolen Future, talking about fluoride, or what was it talking about?
No, it was talking about other contaminants, the organophosphates? Organophosphates, yeah.
All right, fine. And, of course, they would work then very, very similar to the fluoride, its impact on the mind?
Oh, yes. Well, on the IQ, you know, reducing the IQ.
All right, fine. We're going to be back here in just a moment. And, of course, with our special guest this evening, Dr. Richard Folks, associate editor, one of the associate editors of Fluoride Journal. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here, and of course our guest this evening is Dr. Richard Folks. He's the associate, one of the associate editors of Fluoride Journal, and this is such an important subject because here we're talking in California. There's an organized effort now. In fact, this is the law in the state of California where every community with over, I think, 10,000 hookups to the water system is going to have to fluoridate their water. And, of course, this is a situation where I believe a lot of politicians have been bought off by powerful people who seem to have an agenda, and that is that all of the water in the United States will be fluoridated. And the incredible thing is they don't fluoridate the water over in Europe, do they? And what about the dental caries of children over there?
Well, there's no difference, really. Some of the European countries did fluoridate, but most of them have stopped it on continental Europe. Ireland is almost 100% fluoridated. The United Kingdom is about 10%, so they're pushing it there. But countries such as the Netherlands and Germany and France and so forth, some of them, if they did fluoridate, it was for a short period of time, and they decided that it was just too toxic and too risky. And not only that, but studies show that it doesn't reduce dental cavities.
And so they don't have any more dental cavities over there than we have here, do they?
No. Well, there's been a decline over the last few decades in dental caries in both fluoridated and unfluoridated areas. So this could be due to better nutrition, perhaps, or better dental oral hygiene, other factors.
I'd like your impression of, you know, one of the things they say, of course, reading this article that's published by the CDC on this subject, they talk about how really, of course, if you ingest fluoride, well, you might get a little in the saliva, but it's not enough to do any good. You really get, of course, the level up when you brush your teeth with fluoridated toothpaste. You get 1,000 times as much fluoride when you brush your teeth with fluoridated toothpaste, and that's what's going to kill the bacterium, and that's what's going to prevent the caries. Now, is that valid? That does this really kill the bacteria? And do you think that that could play a part in cutting down on the cavities?
Well, there are studies that do show that there's some benefit from using topical fluoride, such as in toothpaste and applications and so forth. Now, it's debatable. One theory is that it softens up the enamel and sort of acts as a sealant, you know, makes enamel flow into the cavity and this type of thing. And there's also the theory that it could act as a bacterial agent, as you say.
I mean, it kills the bacteria. After all, it's a deadly poison, and you put it in your mouth, it's going to kill the bacteria. But what about the amount of fluoride that's actually absorbed into your system when you're using these toxic levels? Because they tell us if you swallow, into the toothpaste, you better go to a poison center.
Yeah, well, it's particularly true of children, of course. And it's horrible to contemplate that the gel that's used, the APF gel, is put in trays. The toxic dose for, say, a six-year-old child is held in those plates, and if it were to swallow it, as some have in the past, then you're in real trouble from acute toxicity.
And this is, of course, when you go to the dental office, and they want you to take a mouthful of this terrible green stuff and just hold it in your mouth, and as long as you spit it out, you're only getting probably a small dose of fluoride, but if you swallow it, of course, some people have actually died, haven't they? Children, especially?
Well, yes, of course. Well, see, ordinary toothpaste contains 1,000 parts per million fluoride, and the more powerful one contains 1,500 parts per million toothpaste. And when you work out the toxic doses, just for, say, a two-year-old child, just 2 ounces of that 1,000 part per million fluoride toothpaste is enough to be fatal.
Well, I'll tell you, as I've been studying this more and more, I've given up my fluoridated toothpaste and using non-fluoridated toothpaste. And, of course, I just feel an awful lot better because my understanding is that it can act certainly on the bone. One of the reasons why so many people are having a lot of dental disease, not necessarily to the teeth, but the gums and all that, is simply because of the fluoridated toothpaste. Do you know anything at all about that?
Well, I haven't seen any studies that indicated that it gave gum disease.
All right, fine. This is something that Dr. David...
But, people do have reactions to it, and some of the symptoms of being exposed to fluoride are pretty strange, skin rashes and even some nerve damage.
All right, hold that thought, because we're going to have to just take a quick break here. We'll be right back in just a moment with my special guest, and welcome your calls here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening, Dr. Richard Foulkes, one of the associate editors of Fluoride Magazine. We're talking about the toxic effects of fluoride. We're talking about the toxic effect of fluoride that is in your toothpaste, the toxic effect of fluoride that is in tea, because actually tea is what has 30, 40 parts per a million of fluoride, whereas of course drinking water only has one part per million. And of course, if you drink too much tea, there's some woman recently that actually came down with skeletal fluorosis, and when they tracked it back, it went right back to the fact she was drinking a couple of gallons of tea a day. But what about the absorption of fluoride when you're using the toothpaste with the 1,000 parts or 1,500 parts per million in the toothpaste? Is there any studies of that, or is there any possibility?
Well, I haven't seen any, but it's my understanding that some of the fluoride is absorbed through the gums. But I don't know of any specific study that has made a big case of that.
Well, what about the impact on the bones and making the bones more brittle?
Well, this is the thing, of course. The fluoride, when you ingest fluoride, whether you breathe it in or whether you have it in your food or drinking water, 50%, if your kidneys are healthy, is excreted through the kidneys. The other 50% is taken into the body, mostly in bone, so that the diagnosis of skeletal fibrosis, which is the crippling variety, is usually made on seeing an increased bone mass, and the bones look heavier than the normal bone, and this is the accumulation of the fluoride. Also, the fluoride causes calcification of ligaments and even the spinous ligaments within the spinal canal. So that's a number of people, particularly in the endemic fluorosis areas in China and India, end up being paralyzed by two reasons. One is the direct toxic effect on the spinal nerves, the encroachment of heavy bone, and also the encroachment of the calcified ligaments within the spinal canal.
And just pressing that on the nerves and on the spinal canal itself. So this is a very real problem, which I don't think most orthopedists are aware of. I know certainly when I was practicing orthopedics, I didn't have time to read the Fluoride Journal or much of anything else other than orthopedics magazines. And so I don't think the average doctor has any idea of the multiple toxic effect of fluoride, either fluoridated water or the other fluoride compounds we encounter.
Just doesn't appear in the differential diagnosis.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this evening is Dr. Richard Folks, who's associate editor of Fluoride Journal. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. And, of course, Dr. Folks was bringing out earlier that that there's certainly Index Medicus, which is published by the U.S. Public Health Service, why they will not index a fluoride, the Fluoride Journal. PubMed up in the Internet will not index any of the articles out of the Fluoride Journal. In other words, there is an organized effort to conceal the truth, in my estimation, about the terribly toxic effects of fluoride and certainly of water fluoridation from the average physician who's going up there. He wants to pick up something. He goes to the Index Medicus, and there's nothing there. He goes to PubMed and so the other Internet sites. There's nothing there. And of course, he shrugs his and says, obviously there can't be a problem. Now, my understanding is that there have been some people, very prominent people, good researchers, government employees, who tried to come forward and bring out the truth about the toxic, carcinogenic effect of certainly on fluoride on animals, or the impact of fluoridated water on animals as far as their behavior is concerned, what it sends their brain, and they've actually been fired from their jobs. Does that sort of thing really happen?
Well, of course, Chris Bryson in his book covers the case of Dr. Phyllis Malnick, and that happened to her, and I'm sure he has other examples in his book of people that have carried out studies that didn't say what the establishment wanted them to say, and they got the door.
And I think that's rather frightening when we find out that there really is an organized, concerted effort to silence anybody who's trying to get the truth out. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Pennsylvania. And again, our telephone number, 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California, 464-8295. Roger, do you have a question?
Yeah, thanks. Just one gentleman. And that is there any validity to what I had heard that even though in the green or black teas, I had heard the fluoride levels are roughly 9 times in all variants, that it's in the chemical form that's somehow less harmful than the other forms. And God bless.
Thanks so much. Is there any truth to that? Roger's asking, is the fluoride in tea any less harmful in a different form?
No, I think the tea fluoride is a real danger. Now, there are compounds of fluoride that don't exert as much effect on the body, and that's mostly kind of calcium fluoride that you find in some wells. The people there don't seem to suffer because the fluoride is bound more strongly to the calcium. But so far as I know, I don't know what form the fluoride is in, and in tea in the chemical structure, but certainly it's high. One of the major problems in China is that in some parts of China, particularly in the northwest part of the country, you know, it's a huge country, people drink what they call brick tea. And it's a very high fluoride tea, and children are given it as a main beverage as soon as they're weaned. And of course, the amount of dental and skeletal fluorosis in that part of China is extremely high.
And so they're getting that in the water, they're getting it in the tea, and of course, yep, it's having an impact on their bodies. In fact, I've
seen, they also probably burn coal in the houses too. But brick tea, as being named by the Chinese, is one of the major sources of skeletal fluorosis in China.
And so the people really in other countries realize the toxic effects. They certainly are very well aware of this. And in China, they're very well aware of it. And in India, the people of on the continent in Europe will not. There's almost no place that they have fluoridated the water. I think that in Bern, Switzerland, they did it until recently, and they gave it up there. Some people think that that they fluoridate the water, at least in Northern Ireland, to keep the people subdued, because there's some suggestion that this is a very effective means of mass medication to lower the aggressiveness. Have you heard any stories of that sort of
stuff? Well, there was a rumor that the Russians used it during the war or something, but, well, I suppose it's possible. And you've got it. Now, in Southern Ireland, it's 100% fluoridated.
It is.
I don't know about Northern Ireland. I think it's sort of hit and miss.
All right, fine.
But there's certainly, there have been stories about how it's used to keep people quiet. And you have to realize that maybe there's some element of truth in it, because some of our great contemporary drugs like Prozac contain fluoride.
And that's one of these serotonin
right,
selective
lexapine, yeah.
Right, and it actually prevents the reabsorption of serotonin, so you have the more constant levels of serotonin. And Luvoft and so many of the other drugs, Prilosec, I think, are these are all related to have a fluoride base, at least my
that's
understanding.
Right. Yeah. And of course, that's another source of fluoride in our bodies, aside from diet and water and air.
Now, I've heard that girls go through their menarche much earlier in fluoridated areas, and there seem to be some studies that show there's a definite impact on the endocrine system. Have you heard anything at all along that line?
Well, I know that certainly it affects the thyroid, and of course, hypothyroidism can also be related to disturbances in the menstrual cycle, in addition to cretinism or, you know, mental deficiency and all sorts of orthopedic abnormalities. But I haven't really encountered, in my experience, which isn't all that wide, of course, any specific study that points to delay in the menarche.
What about
there may be.
What about the possibility of it being carcinogenic?
Well, there have been studies, and Burke and Yamiamis, the two American investigators, did a study of the 10 largest fluoridated cities and the 10 largest non-fluoridated cities in the United States, and found that there was a higher death rate in the fluoridated cities from various types of cancer. There have been epidemiological studies, two of them, that have shown a higher incidence of bone cancer, osteosarcoma, in people living in fluoridated areas.
What about animal studies? Have there been
this gave rise to the National Toxicological Program study on rats and fluoride that was ordered by Congress. When the results of that came out, I think it was about 1990, many people felt that the adverse effects had been downplayed, but still it showed that some of the rats fed fluoridated water developed bone cancer, and a very rare type of kidney cancer developed in another one of the rats. So from that rat study indicated that there was a possibility that there was a relationship between fluoride ingestion and cancer. The Chinese say that there's a higher incidence of cancer in their endemic fluorosis areas, various kinds.
Do you think this has any, plays any part in premature aging or other forms of, you already mentioned, of course, the joint effects on this, but is there anything to suggest that that people may have premature aging in areas where there's very high levels of endemic fluoride?
Yeah, the Chinese studies seem to indicate that. There's a higher incidence of cataracts and the bone deficiencies and so forth, so that's certainly not maybe related. But John Yamiamis published a book a few years ago, he's a leaked John Yamiamis, called The Aging Factor, in which he had some studies indicating that fluoride and living and drinking fluoridated water was associated with premature aging.
And George, Dr. Yamiamis was a great champion trying to get this information out, did a great job.
Oh, yeah, well, he was another one that got sacked because he made his views too clear.
I really think that what we're really up against is that if you are a scientist or you work in a university in an academic setting and you tell the truth about this sort of thing, you're going to lose your job. Now, there's a Harvey Limebach who's up in the University of Toronto, my understanding, associate professor of preventive dentistry, and we actually have a wonderful interview with him, a video interview. You can actually see his views as he talks about the danger of water fluoridation. He initially supported it, and then, of course,
sure,
he began doing his research, and when he found out that how wrong he was an honest man. He came out and gave interviews and came out publicly against water fluoridation, and I eventually talked to Dr. Limebach, and he said, "I can't come on your program. I've been threatened and told I will lose my job, and I'm not going to risk my children and just for this issue." So this is the sort of
thing. But he's been very outspoken, though, and I'm giving him credit, because there was a one time when he and I were on two different sides. Of course, years ago, I supported fluoridation, too, and recommended that fluoride should be mandatory in the province of British Columbia, where I did a study on the healthcare system.
Now, you worked in the healthcare system there in British Columbia, didn't you?
Yeah. I was commissioned to carry out a study of the entire healthcare system in the province of British Columbia and make recommendations as to how it could be rationalized, which is a pretty tall order. But it meant that I studied every aspect of the healthcare system and came up with something like 264 recommendations, one of which was that fluoride should be mandatory. And I accepted this view because it was presented to me by the top people in the Canadian government and the provincial government and the dean of the dental faculty, the College of Dental Surgeons, and so on. But years later, back in 1991, my views were challenged when they were going to fluoridate Bellingham's water supply, which is just south of us here. And somebody challenged me and said, "I don't believe it." So I said, well, look at my original papers that were given to me, and we'll do some research in the university libraries. Well, within a couple of weeks, you can find enough evidence, even at that time, to show that not only was fluoridation not effective in reducing dental cavities, that it certainly wasn't safe.
And of course, it's awfully hard sometimes when you've taken a position to reverse your position. But then, at one time, I was a flaming liberal who used to argue in favor of socialized medicine. But that was when I was young and foolish, and I had not really had a thought of my own. I was simply parroting what I'd learned in university. And I look back on those years; they were wonderful years. But so much of it was not education, but indoctrination. Well, let's go to Paul, who's calling. And Paul, did you have a question?
Yeah, I got a very important one, and I don't know why no one else has asked it. Are they fluoridating the bottled water?
Oh, it's fine. Do they fluoridate bottled water?
Well, it's not supposed to be fluoridated, but, you know, there have been examinations of bottled water. There was one in Washington State here, but these people were selling bottles that were claiming to be glacial water from the glacier up in the Rocky Mountains somewhere, but actually it was Seattle water. And of course, what gave it away was the fact that it was fluoridated to one part per million.
So sometimes you'll actually be able to look on the label and they'll say, yes, this is distilled spring water and we've added fluoride to it. Other times they may simply lie. It's hard to know of whether
it's sometimes it comes right out of the fluoridated water tap.
I think the latter is probably what...
Okay.
But you have to be very careful. And this causes a bit of a problem because a lot of these people that have very strange symptoms and so on, and if you have an index of suspicion that the symptoms might be being caused by fluoridated water.
What are the symptoms?
The best thing to put them on is distilled water and see what happens.
Well, that's what I've been filtering through a British Birkfield is distilled water that I get from Walmart.
Okay.
And I haven't noticed anything about fluoride on the label.
Of course, the only way to get fluoride out of water, of course, is with the reverse osmosis or by distillation. Which is a pretty expensive process.
Right. I think your British Birkfield, if you have the post filters on there, they should do a pretty good job.
I can't afford those at this time.
Okay.
What kind of filters?
Yeah.
Well, there's
I got the super stirrer seals, but I don't have the bottom filters.
Okay. Well, I hope maybe one of the. Do you have the big Berkey or have the big Berkey light?
I have the. I have the old stainless steel one. It's not the Royal. It's the one that does 30 gallons a day. And wanted to ask you, what are the symptoms of fluoride? If you know you think the fluoride's causing you trouble, what are the symptoms?
Well, the preliminary symptoms before bone changes take place so far, they're pretty vague. I mean, some people will have, and one sees this in examining people in industry and in China, irritation of the stomach, you know, so-called functional dyspepsia. People take Tums and ranitidine and these sort of drugs for.
Is that like
other people will have pins and needles? Some people will have a rash.
Is that
one of the early signs too? Is stiffness. You know, when you're sitting in your car parked and you're going to pull out on the road and you turn your head just a little bit to look out the side window.
Yeah.
When that hurts, that could also be a symptom of a very early skeletal fluorosis.
Did you say the word peptic?
Yes, he said that gastritis, you'll get this.
Oh, gastritis.
Upset.
And I think the thing is that these symptoms are very subtle. It has to do with your IQ. It has to do with bone changes.
Right.
But until you fall and break a hip, why, you're not going to realize that your bones are actually softer.
Well, I think that it's done its job on the IQ in this country. Look at how we're living.
I know.
Isn't it sad?
I share your concern, but help us get the word out, Paul.
I am, Dr. Stan, and thank you so much, and both of you doctors.
God bless.
Thank you.
Thanks so much. Well, we'll go to Jack calling from Michigan. Jack, do you have a quick question? We're almost out of time.
Right. Okay. On the fluoridation of bottled water, here in Michigan, there's this company called Culligan, and I had been going there to purchase one of their franchise offices, and then they announced that they were going to be promoting fluoridated bottled water by Culligan, and so I... Dr. Stan, I gave him your program information and Chris Bryson's book, Fluoride Deception. I told him about it. And when I came back the next time to buy water, they wouldn't let me buy any water. I had to go somewhere else.
Okay, fine. Well, that's what you get for telling the truth. That's
well, I guess the main thing is it should be, bottled water should be labeled. It is, most of the bottled water in Canada is labeled with the percentage of fluoride in the water.
Okay.
And sometimes even glacier water has a bit.
Really, there. Of course, I like grapefruit juice and orange juice, and of course, a lot of this is made from concentrates, and we know that a lot of those concentrates are, they use the water, of course, fluoridated water, but there are products that come directly that actually just squeezed orange juice and squeezed grapefruit juice, and I forgot the name of it, but my wife gets it for me. It's really great, and I don't have to worry about fluoride there. Hey, thanks so much for calling, Jack. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and of course our guest this evening has been Dr. Richard Folks, and he's one of the associate editors of the Fluoride Journal, and we've got just about 3 minutes before we have to let you go. What message would you like to leave with our listeners this evening?
Well, the message I'd like to leave with your listeners is that not to believe the statement that fluoride in the water supply is necessary because it's never been shown to be an essential element, and that the fluoride does not decrease dental cavities when it's ingested through the water supply, and it's certainly far from safe because there are a number of adverse effects that can result from drinking it, both to the teeth and to the body, the skeleton, soft tissues, and so forth.
Well, I certainly agree with you, and I think it's so vitally important that we get the truth out to the American people. They're not going to get it through the regular channels. They're not going to get it from the doctor. And not that he doesn't want to do what's right. He just doesn't know. And I know until I began studying this, I didn't know. And the dentists don't know. They're simply doing what they're told by their dental boards, what they taught in medical and their dental schools. So, really, I think this is such an important subject. The only way we are possibly going to influence what the doctors and what the dentists believe is for you out there in the listening audience to get the information, to get some of the articles, and we actually have them. We'll be glad to send you copies of some of the things if you'd like, but we can tell you where to get them. And then you take them to your doctor, you take them to your dentist, ask them to, if he can challenge these, if he has any articles that will show you that these things are true, especially the fact that even the American Dental Association has come out and said it doesn't do any good to ingest it, but we want you to ingest it anyway. It's the most incredible thing in the world. It's, sometimes I think I'm living like Alice in Wonderland.
One of the websites that has a lot of information on, of course, is fluoridealert.org. And this is full of information.
Fluoride Alert.
Do you usually give out the website?
We really do, fluoridealert.org. Keepersofthewell.org. And, of course, the fluoridejournal.com.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much for being with us. I appreciate it. God bless you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
I've enjoyed it.
Okay, I have too. Bye-bye. Well, I guess this evening has been Dr. Richard Foulkes, and of course, we've had a unique opportunity to, really get into the background of two important metals. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and of course, I think that both subjects this evening, the one on mercury, which is poisoning our children's minds, and fluoride, which is poisoning our children's minds, and as Paul said, one of our callers, look at what's happening to America. These products are really having an impact. I believe they are. I believe that this is one reason why the IQs of the American children are much lower than children throughout the world. And in competitive tests with children from other countries, the American children just can't compete at all. I don't think it's all a product of our educational system. I think we're poisoning their minds with fluoride, with mercury, with aspartame, which is NutraSweet, which is toxic to the brain. They know what they're doing, but they do not want you to know that they're poisoning our children. So get the information, get the details, and if you care about your children, if you care about your family, about your future, about your freedom, help us to get the message out. Well, this is the point where, of course, I want to once again mention that we are going to reprint my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and if you would like to get a case of the books, we can only tell you that they are very, very inexpensive by the case, and of course you can get a case with 62 books in it. If you'd like to know more, give us a call of 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927, because by printing a large number of books, why, we can certainly get the individual cost of books down tremendously. And of course, we want you to get the books, and we want you to pass them out to get people begin listening to our programs, to get them to begin to understand that we're involved in a spiritual battle being fought on a political, ideological, and cultural battle field. And so give us a call at 1-800-544-8927 if you're interested in getting a case of 62 books. And, of course, we've sold almost a third of those that we're going to, I should say we've got orders for almost a third of what we're going to be disseminating, but we're just hoping to get them out. And, of course, the more we have out, the more people that begin to understand the true nature of why things are happening. It is not that we live in a world gone mad. It is that there are people out there who know exactly what they're doing and don't want you to know what they're doing. And then, of course, you would like to get our floor tape set on fluoride, and we have an update of our floor tape set on fluoride. And then we have Chris Bryson's book, and we have Dr. Blaylock's book, and a great DVD on fluoride. So they're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. We actually have a floor tape set on mercury. We'll soon be having another one, but it's not available yet. We have, of course, the video entitled Uninformed Consent. We have a four-tape set on aspartame. The book, Excitotoxins, The Taste That Kills, by Dr. Russell Blaylock, and his book, Health and Nutrition Secrets That Can Save Your Life. That, of course, cover all of the things we've talked about, fluoride, mercury, aspartame. What about getting your children vaccinated? Should you believe what the pediatrician tells you, how you have to get your child vaccinated? Oh, it's terrible. In fact, there was an article I was reading just the other day about chickenpox, and they've got all the children with chickenpox, and then they're beginning to say, but what happens later on? Are we going to have an increase in herpes and shingles because people have not been immunized properly? When they have chickenpox, they don't get shingles when they get old. Shingles is a terrible, terrible disease, terribly painful. That's exactly the same virus. And now we're finding, now that we've been immunizing all the children, that more and more people are coming down with shingles. We've done away with one minor problem and created another major problem. So sometimes things are not exactly as they would appear to be. And there's between man's plan and Tom and God's plan and eternity, there's an infinite quality of difference. Well, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Our website, radioliberty.com. Please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for my ministry. For our provision and protection until Monday. May the Lord be with you.